You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, episode 318, recorded on September 22nd. I'm your host, Sarah Brady Wagner, and today we are covering how to move forward with the Me Too movement. Welcome to the show. It is great to have you join us, Ms. Susan Hogarth.
I'm glad to be here.
Susan is the chairman of the Libertarian Party of North Carolina.
Chairperson.
Chairperson.
Or chair.
I don't know. Didn't you say you like chair lady?
Chair lady. That works. Not chairman.
As well as the founder of the Radical Caucus nationwide.
One of the co-founders.
Okay.
Give you your due
introductions. Are there any other bona fides you would like to?
No. I'd rather avoid any other.
All right. So today we are taking over the podcast because Mr. Chris Spangle is doing his paid day job all week and has decided to hand it off to some of us amateurs to see how the network reacts to us as well. So today we wanted to take the opportunity to really kind of give a deep dive on the Me Too movement, what it's trying to achieve, as well as like how successful it's been at going about that, and how we can possibly move forward in what to me seems very much like a overall cultural shift where we're trying to kind of renegotiate and reestablish new gender norms for interaction. Just trying to make sure that we all are on the same page about what's okay. But apparently we're not. And that's what this has whole, you know, brought up as a cultural conversation.
Yeah, I can't decide if that's an exciting thing that we're in for or if that's just an unprofitable upheaval in society.
Well, so we think, you know, hopefully it deserves the time that we're going to spend talking about it.
And certainly.
So the history of the Me Too movement, it apparently started back in 2006 by a social activist named Tanara Burke on MySpace. Do you remember? Yes. Do you remember MySpace? where she was talking about her own experiences and was talking to a young girl who had been sexually abused. But it really did not take purchase until Alyssa Milano. On October 15th of last year, she tweeted a small personal note that said, "Me too," suggested by a friend. "If all the women who have been sexually harassed or assaulted wrote Me Too as a status, we might give other people a sense of the magnitude of the problem." By the end of the day, Me Too, hashtag Me Too, had been used more than 200,000 times. By the end of the next day, it had been used more than 500,000 times. On Facebook, 4.7 million people had used the phrase for a total of 12 million times within 24 hours. Resulting in 45% of social media users had a friend who posted the term in that time. And since those first few days, the number is now nearly 100%. I mean, if you're on social media, you've at least come across this in one form or another.
It's almost as ubiquitous as pink ribbons. Cancer awareness. We're all aware of breast cancer. And I think now we're all aware of sexual harassment.
Well, what happened? Whatever happened to the yellow wristbands?
Is
this just disappeared as Lance Armstrong had to go sit down?
Yeah,
all right. Well, that's a whole other topic. So a lot of the stories that came out of this then focus a lot on high-profile women coming forward with very specific stories of being, in one way or another, treated, I want to say differently, but I mean, they really did. The kind of overarching aspect of it was this feeling of being demeaned or treated outright aggressively. Some of them were cases of rape and assault, but all of these women who had these cases that for one reason or another, they either didn't report, or if they had reported at the time, like, it was ignored. And so, well, I guess, sorry, go ahead.
You're more up on this than I am, Sarah. So maybe you know this. Have men embraced that hashtag in the same sense of sexual assault? And how have they been looked at by feminists or for using that?
So there have been a couple that I've seen, but it's not at all nearly as prolific, which gets to, you know, one of those gender imbalances where men and women experience sexual assault at about the same rate. Like, it's not just women who are victims of sexual assault.
Right.
But we do see a lot fewer men speaking up in terms of the hashtag MeToo movement.
I think that's interesting.
I do too. And to me, it's kind of one of the big unaddressed issues within the movement itself.
So I have two questions, and I know these are going to sound really bad coming from a female.
That's kind of the idea. Go for it.
So my first is that, as we talked about before, and I talk about every time I talk about this, I'm not sure what makes sexual assault any different from any kind of assault. I mean, and I have been sexually assaulted, so please stop right now when you're writing your note saying you're only saying that because you've never been sexually assaulted. I have. I still wonder what makes it different than just a regular physical assault. And I can't remember my other point, so I'll probably interrupt you again when it comes up to me. Is actually the entire ubiquity of sexual assault. So I feel fairly certain that everyone, female and male, have at some point in their life experienced some sort of sexual
misconduct,
upset. It may be when they're a teen, it may be when they're a child, it may be when they're adult, it may be all three. Not saying that that makes it any less significant or noteworthy or something that we shouldn't be talking about, but I just wonder at the total ubiquity of it. I have trouble thinking of anyone I know who hasn't experienced some level of what would be called sexual misconduct.
Yeah. I would agree.
Male, with
that
female, completely. Anyone.
And I, at least in my experience, the men that I know, they're just as likely to be traumatized from whatever experience. So there's not a whole lot of really like good reasoning as to why we don't take that as seriously. But I think that kind of speaks to the difference. Legally, I'm totally on board with you that like there shouldn't be this extra category. You know, I know we've talked personally before about our great annoyance that there is a separate crime for assault and assault on a woman or child.
Right.
Because they're
so helpless.
Yeah. That's why I take offense to being grouped with children.
As nice as they are.
But yes. Actually, I think in North Carolina that law covers women, children, and law enforcement officers.
I'm surprised it doesn't cover pets, you know, yeah. Abuse of a pet or, you know, your wife.
But that we treat it differently in this, like, men hurt other men, and that's one kind of situation, but anyone hurts a woman, and it's different.
Right. It is nice to know that I can deck a man, and it's only a misdemeanor. Yeah, but if he slaps me back, that it's a felony. Yeah. It is not nice to know that, actually. I'm being sarcastic, if that's not clear.
Well, I've always wondered then how often is that enforced in female-on-female assault cases?
Interesting.
I would love to see that statistic.
We should try that out sometime.
That might be fun. I think you bring up a very valid issue in that there, when we're talking about aggression and violence between two people, whether it's sexual in nature or just violent in nature, shouldn't necessarily come into play because they're both wrong. I guess that...
Right. People talk about a greater sense of violation. I just don't know. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it because, as I say, I've experienced it, but I think there's this kind of weird Victorian thing that, you know, it's one thing if a guy or if someone decks you, you know, punches you, and it's another thing if someone gropes you. I think that's maybe giving too much sense to, you know, bits and parts that are just parts of our body. I mean, on the one sense, feminism has this big thing about, you know, parts of our body are just parts of our body and we should desexualize breasts and things like that. And on the other hand, everyone wants to get upset if someone touches your butt as opposed to punches you in the face.
Yeah.
Honestly, if someone hits me in the head, it's more of an assault than if someone, you know, gropes me or even... I know this is terrible. I said this once before on Facebook and I got extremely roasted for it. So I'm going to say it here because I actually stand by it. To me, it would be much worse to be given a concussion by being whacked on the head than to being raped, because both are recoverable, but my brain is much more important to me than other parts. So that's kind of how I feel.
I can see why you got roasted. I guess my only thought of that is like,
I don't know
long-term
how I would...
consequences. There are lots of really bad long-term consequences that can come with rape.
True. And concussion.
Yeah.
So I don't know how I would, and to be honest, even after kind of, I don't know if I would say the same after that happened. So, you know, I can imagine that wouldn't be true. And I can imagine people being very angry now and I can hear all the typing. And that's fine. It is meant to be challenged. I just think that we give way too much credence to certain parts of our body, you know, that over other parts. And to me, they're not necessarily the most important parts.
I'd agree with that. Well, and one of the things that kind of confuses me on that issue of assault versus sexual assault is that a lot of times there's this kind of gray issue of intent involved, where like, if the small of your back being my favorite example, if a man puts his hand on the small of your back and it's unwelcome, whether that is just unwanted touching, which is legally a whole other statute, or if that's sexual assault, it kind of comes down to, was it intended in a sexual manner? Or was it taken in a sexual manner? And I don't know, I guess those are the kinds of situations that I feel like the whole movement has done more to gray than it has to clarify. Is, you know, we're all kind of in, we're in agreement on what like assault looks like and like you know, a clear violence. And in those situations, the difficulty is saying that, well, in those situations, you need to also speak up for yourself and say when something's done wrong. But then that gets into, there's a lot of perfectly valid reasons why people don't come forward in those situations. The number one being how, especially women are treated when they do say something. But there's, I don't know, it's complicated because there's a lot of reasons why people react in that way too. And so we kind of have this weird cultural mishmash of what's okay and what isn't, and how you perceive it.
When we were talking earlier, you said something about you feel like this is a good time in history and that one of the lessons, and I may be misinterpreting what you said, but is that people, and not just women, but people are going to have to learn to set those boundaries and to speak up when those boundaries are crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Which to some people may seem a little bit like victim blaming, but I know that it doesn't come from that place. And I just think that that's, I agree with you. I think that we're now maybe addressing one side of the equation more than the other side. Mm-hmm. And the other side is having people speak up more for themselves.
Yes. Which is kind of what I hope that this, I hope to eventually see this kind of move into is, actually I think Jewel, Had made a statement at one point about her view on the Me Too movement that was, she said, I would like to see hashtag Me Too at some point develop into hashtag not me.
That's so funny because not ever having read that, I promise, that's what was going through my head. And I'm glad I listened to you say that because I am 100% with her.
So when I think about this, and I probably have to think about this more than most people do, partially because I work with small children, and consent is now a big thing that everybody wants their children taught early because it's really easy to teach them if you teach them early. I mean, most concepts are really easy to teach if you teach early, especially these really big, complex social issues. Like, we teach kids about gender roles and everything when they're very young, not doing it intentionally, but just like because those are the things that we're wired to learn about when we're young. So, teaching consent to little kids and teaching, like, I have had to answer a four-year-old ask me the question, what is rape? And that then puts you in a position of having to think of how to explain this issue in an age-appropriate way, but still being able to answer the question. What I came up with, actually, after talking to some other nannies, is rape is when someone puts their body in yours without your permission.
Wow, that sounds really... If I put myself back in a four-year-old brain, which isn't difficult for me, that sounds really science fiction-y. But
well, what they understood from that is every little kid has had an experience where some littler kid has stuck their fingers in your mouth.
Hmm.
And so they connect that to what somebody putting their body in yours would be.
So,
and they understand that, like, oh, that's a terrible thing. But they also already understand, like, you don't touch people without it being okay with them. And if somebody says it's not okay for you to touch me, then you just don't touch them.
So I think that's great.
But
you're good at that. But one of the other things that I think we need to teach children is to, I don't want to say respect authority, but to take direction when it is appropriate to take direction and to know the difference. So if you're in a job situation or a classroom situation, you know, and someone says, I think you need to, you're standing here and you need to stand 5 feet to the right, and they have a reason for that, or maybe even they don't have a reason for that, you need to be able to do that without saying, you're violating me, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I wonder if we're, just being cynical and old and all that, I'm just going to say this, but I don't... It's not exactly what I think, but let me play devil's advocate. I wonder if we're raising a generation. I'm not going to say millennials, but I wonder if we're raising a generation of people who are overly touchy. And I don't mean touchy.
Yeah,
I mean
I
the opposite of touchy, like, you know.
Sensitive.
Overly. What was the word? That's not exactly what I mean either. I mean, just maybe too, I don't want to say assertive of personal rights because I'm a libertarian. That doesn't make any sense. But too unwilling, too unpliable, too unbiddable. You know, who are always wanting others around them to make adjustments rather than being willing to make adjustments.
Well, I would agree with that. That's something I definitely see come up in kids, but also is something that you address early on. You discuss, you know, those fine differences between, you know, you, it's never okay for somebody to touch your body in a way that you're not okay with. But, okay. So the example that always comes to mind, because it comes up with like every family now, is hugging. And the new norm with kids, the new, like, you know,
you can't be the creepy old aunt,
it's not okay to force your kids to be hugged.
Right.
But I am a big believer in it is okay for grandma and grandpa when your child says, no, I don't want to hug you. It's okay for them to show that really makes me very sad because I wanted to give you a hug because that's how I wanted to show you that I care. I don't love you any less, but that does make me sad. And that helps the kids to like understand, like, oh, okay, maybe what I want isn't the only thing that matters.
Exactly.
And I need to consider other people too. So in that situation, you usually have like once or twice that the kid has that moment of like, it's okay for me to say, no, I don't want to hug. And then they go, but, you know, I do want to hug you because I know that makes you feel good. And that makes me feel good too. And then it's okay from there. But they have that ability to know when it's okay to say no. And you practice that with them. And I feel like that's kind of the part that then gets carried over into adulthood. Is like they have the ability to speak up for themselves and know that nobody's going to speak up for them. And that if they don't speak up for themselves, they're putting themselves in a worse position than they need to be. Like, I don't know, I kind of went in tangent there. But that there's two sides of that equation. You can't always expect everybody else to adjust for you.
You're giving me, hope for the next generation. If only everyone had great nannies.
Yeah, so not everybody has that. But, yeah. You know, it's important to have both sides of that equation. You both need to have everybody understand that it's not okay to violate someone's person. But you also have to have people understand that if you're not okay with something, it's your responsibility to say so now or as soon as you can say something and not to let yourself be tread on, not to let yourself be abused or used. That's not to say that will keep you from being victimized.
Yeah.
But that is step one in being able to defend yourself.
Actually, to a large extent, that will keep you from being victimized.
I'm just saying it's not like a guarantee.
It occurs to me, it occurred to me very early in life, actually, as a teen, that I never had the issues with, obnoxious boyfriends or obnoxious male. I had a lot of issues with obnoxious males, but with guys making presumptions. And I used to joke about, having the word bitch tattooed on my forehead. But I think people like me. I mean, some people anyway. But I do think that having a certain internal attitude does change people's reaction to you and temper it. If we can cultivate a little bit of, maybe it's not feminist to say a little bit of bitchiness, but a little bit of more internal strength in women, and not the kind of strength that bears and endures, but the kind of strength that doesn't put up with it.
Yeah.
Then that could be a good thing.
I would absolutely agree with that. I want to kind of loop back to what you had said earlier, and you'd asked about men coming forward with Me Too. And in scrolling through my notes over here, I came across, I actually do have Terry Crews. Early on, you remember this, Terry Crews, who is, what has Terry Crews been in? Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Have you ever seen, what's the movie?
Why do all these people
Idiocracy?
Seem to be?
Have you ever seen Idiocracy?
No. Why do all these people seem to be actors and actresses?
Well,
I mean,
that is an interesting thing, is there's actually been some talk about that people in the music industry haven't spoken up as much.
Well, people in the engineering, they have. But, maybe it's just because they tend to be more, I don't know.
I think it's just like a high profile thing.
Yeah.
Those are celebrities.
Tangenting.
So this is from the AV Club. Terry Crews came forward to share his story of being groped by an unnamed Hollywood executive in front of his wife at a party, and the shame and fear he felt that prevented him from speaking about it earlier. Hopefully, me coming forward with my story will deter a predator and encourage someone who feels hopeless, he wrote. It's a powerful reminder that sexual assault can happen to anyone.
Good for him.
You know, and that this whole issue is more about
power. Did his boss get retroactively fired?
No.
Doubt it.
Yeah. Well, it was an unnamed Hollywood executive.
Yeah. Maybe someday she'll be roasted. If enough men and women who know.
Actually, from what I understand, it was another man.
Oh, well.
So. It goes back to it's power dynamics.
Oh, assumptions.
It's power dynamics. It's not necessarily just about men, victimizing women. It's people in a position of power over someone else, right, misusing that power is kind of a lot of what it is.
Sure.
So I want to kind of shift forward to discussing the other part of this.
Wait. wait, the Hollywood angle just had me thinking. I just wonder if somewhere in the unpublished notes of Ayn Rand, there is a Me Too moment. I feel like there has to be. Oh. And I feel like she either just dealt with it or maybe she murdered the guy. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's one of those questions is I don't know. When you say just kind of dealt with it, to me, there's a couple of ways that somebody could just deal with it. Because just deal with it might mean standing up for yourself and going to, you know, the person who's abused you and saying, hey, asshole, you know that wasn't okay, right? You do realize that the position you put me in, like this is how it's affected me.
Or it could just mean ignoring it. And I know those are very, very different. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know.
Yeah. And they have very different outcomes then. Because in one way, well, and I think this goes.
I'm not sure they have. It's certainly not back in the 40s. But I'm not even sure now they have very different outcomes.
To me, the reason they would have different outcomes is because in a lot of these cases, if you don't know that you've hurt someone else, then you never reconsider your actions or you never consider if you maybe should change your habits in the future. Yeah. But if somebody comes to you and says, I'm not, even if you can, sometimes they'll come with blame, but even if you come without blame, with having that kind of suspended judgment and saying, even if you weren't trying to hurt me, I need to let you know that what happened was hurtful so that hopefully you don't hurt somebody else again. And without those conversations, then there's a good chance that that whole script and that whole interaction is going to happen again to somebody else.
Yeah.
And to me, like that's part of being able to deal with it yourself too.
Yeah. One of the things that we haven't addressed, and I know you wanted to go on to something else, was the false allegations.
That was what I wanted to go on to.
Then our minds are in sync.
False accusations is obviously an issue in this. And to me, it seems like it's become a more salient issue as the kind of movement has rolled forward. Because as we get into this, if it's so common, then we just kind of have this presumption of belief. And as soon as a new accusation comes out.
Boom, career ruined.
Yeah. The more power that gets, the more
resentment it creates.
Well, and I feel like the more it creates a position for a false accusation to right. be more appealing.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. If you were someone in a sketchy position at work, for instance, and you wanted to get out in a way that was profitable to yourself, what better way than to bring up an accusation against your boss or a coworker?
And this has become, you know, the big topic of conversation now with the Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination, that you have this one story that's come up, like many of the other stories that happened a long time ago, is something that even if it was reported at the time, there's really no way to say that they would be able to have any like hard concrete evidence. It kind of harkens back to the issue of this kind of like sexual assault in the first place, which when it comes to statistics, supposedly about 5% of cases are reported and convicted, and about 5% of cases are false, which leaves about 90% of cases where there's a he said, she said.
Right.
And unless, I would say even when there are rape kits and it's like a really clear cut case, we don't test those half the time. And there's a huge backlog. So
the Kavanaugh case is interesting because in the 6 degrees of or 3 degrees of separation department, someone that you and I both know told me that he was schoolmate of the brother of the accuser. And the interesting thing is that he said he would have dismissed it offhand as a political ploy, except for having this connection and thinking, well, this guy's reliable. He says his sister's reliable. Why wouldn't I believe that? And that's made him go back and re-examine the Anita Hill stuff that he had also dismissed as political. So it's interesting what having a connection does. I tend to be the kind of reserve judgment kind of people. If I ever have a snap judgment. I try to be very suspicious of that in myself, because I, you know, I think that's a recipe for,
I think that's a really good habit to, you know, cultivate.
You read a news story, you can't know what happened. And certainly no one, very few people can know what happened, what, 25 years ago?
Oh, I always get suspicious of any news story that I have like a immediate reaction of agreement with. I'm like, ah, I should probably find another article on this.
Or one that says science says. Sorry, that's one of my hobby horses.
So, according to Quartz, only between 2 and 10% of all reports are false. False accusations are usually motivated by personal and not public reasons. To quote Quartz, in every academic study, one of the most common kinds of false accuser is a teenage girl who tells her parents she was raped to avoid getting in trouble. Unwanted pregnancy is sometimes cited by such girls, but the reason can also be trivial. The phrase missed curfew shows up with disturbing frequency in these cases. As a rule, it's the parents who insist on getting police involved. Two different studies have found that almost half of all false rape complaints are lodged by someone other than the alleged victim, usually by a parent. Another kind of case which evaporates rapidly is that of a person who falsely reports a rape in the hope of getting needed medical care or psychiatric medication. In one study, 6 of the 55 reports classified as false by a police department in 1 year fit this description.
That's just sad.
Like the teens who missed their curfew, these false accusers have no interest in pursuing charges after the lie has served its purpose.
And after the victim has his life ruined, his or her life ruined.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I would wonder how many times in those cases a specific person is named. Because, I mean, in situations of a teenage girl or a, you know, somebody just seeking medication, it would make sense to me that you'd be able to report a rape without being able to say that it was somebody that you knew. It's much more pernicious when you're able to point to a specific person as right. opposed to when you're just making a claim.
Right.
You know, and then you get into all sorts of stereotyping as to who you're imagined to accuse. But so to kind of hit on a case very close to home, let's talk a little bit about the Duke LaCrosse case. False reports have some similarities. According to Crystal Mangum, who is the accuser in the Duke LaCrosse case, was the archetypal false accuser. She had previously reported another brutal rape and kidnapping in which no one was ever charged. She had a previous felony conviction, and she ultimately went to prison for an unrelated crime, which in her case was murdering her boyfriend. She had trouble keeping her stripping job because the combination of drugs she was on, including both antidepressants and methadone, kept making her fall asleep at work. Tragically, she seems to have genuinely suffered sexual abuse as a child, which is another feature that often appears in adult false accusers. The New York Times attempted to explain why such an obvious lie still got so much traction with the media. New York Times public editor explained the media's inability to cover this fairly. They diagnosed the media coverage of the case as the documentary is journalists excited to find all their pet social justice issues in one story. It was white over black. It was male over female. It was rich over poor. It was educated over uneducated. All the things that we know happen in the world come together in one place, and journalists, they just start to quiver with thrill when something like this happens. And we want to make this our star case.
And that's where your inclination, when you see something that immediately excites your sympathy or agreement reflexively.
You should question that.
You should question it. If only everyone could be trained to do that. Mm. But our brains work exactly the opposite in most cases.
That's critical thinking.
Except superior people like you and me.
But I mean, that's critical thinking. That's something that you have to learn. You have to learn to question what you're thinking.
Right. But it's one of the most difficult things for people to learn.
Is it? That's
and absorb. I mean, I don't accept myself. I'm sure a lot of times I respond from gut, as they say, rather than brain.
Yeah. I mean, even when we're trying to be conscious of it, there's still, you have so many reactions in a given day. You can't possibly reliably catch every single one. you can always try. But I think anyone who thinks that they're, you know, perfectly critical of every single thought that they ever have is probably lying to themselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, anyone who thinks they're not lying to themselves is definitely lying to themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the first step to, you know, trying to be the person that you want to be. Well, what happens when we believe false reports before convictions? I mean, this is the difference between the court of, you know, public opinion and actual court cases where you are supposed to have a presumption of innocence. But,
well, here's the thing. If they're as rare as you indicate, you have to ask also what happens if you believe a true accusation before it's prosecuted and judged. I think that's just as dangerous. Sometimes the phrase is used, a person is innocent until proven guilty. I hate that phrase. If you're guilty, you're guilty.
Yeah, but you haven't proven it yet.
But our justice system treats people as innocent until they're proven guilty. And there's a big difference between those two things. And I believe very strongly in that. But it is important to do that because you can be wrong. You can be wrong even in a full conviction. But that, I think just trying to step back from the passion a little bit and, you know, think about reality and think about the mitigating circumstances. And nobody wants to talk about mitigating circumstances in sexual assault because it's totally inexcusable. But just as with any other case of assault or robbery or trespassing, there are often mitigating circumstances, and we should try to develop a bigger sense of compassion toward perpetrators as well as victims. I know that's probably not a popular thing to say these days, but
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that sentiment kind of stretches into a lot of my understanding of justice, is that you have to be able to consider that terrible things happen and people need to be held responsible for terrible things, but it's also people who are involved in those situations, and you have to look at it as both the perpetrator and the victim are both people, and people make mistakes.
Right. And after the situation, unless we're killing people summarily, then both people are still going to exist and have to move forward. And to take away someone's entire life because of a mistake, even a grave mistake, you might as well, you know, put them away for life or kill it. Or execute them as to make the rest of their life unlivable in this, you know, people have to be able to move on. That's all I'm saying.
So, well, let's talk about what happened in the Duke case. Reed Seligman, Colin Finnerty, and Dave Evans were indicted last year on charges of rape, kidnapping, and sexual offense after a woman told police she was attacked at a March 2006 team party where she was hired to perform as a stripper. Duke suspended all three, canceled the team's season, and forced coach Mike Pressler to resign. The previous season, Duke had made it to the finals and was expected to be a contender again that year. The players' families racked up millions of dollars in legal bills in their defense. And this was all just from being indicted. This, you know, this was not the result of a conviction. This was just the result of that false accusation. And I guess in that I'm a little bit, I don't want to say less sensitive to the costs of legal defense, but I mean, that's something that lots of people end up racking up for all sorts of other, you know, unjust causes trying to defend themselves too. You can also take a public defender, but we all, you know that's not necessarily the ideal option. So,
imagine if they had.
Yeah.
They'd be in jail.
They would. But, you know, I do think it is a little too, I don't know, proactive for Duke to go ahead and say, we're going to, you know, suspend Daryl players and try and get the coach to resign and act as though this is a clear-cut case of something that has been proven when all that's happened is an accusation.
Well, again, I'm not really sure what Duke's regulations are. Maybe having a stripper at your function, team function, or maybe it wasn't, I don't know, a private party or whatever, but maybe that is considered conduct unbecoming. So even that could have been enough to get them in hot water with Duke.
Aggravating factors.
You know. No, I'm just saying, like, Duke didn't necessarily have to buy into the accusation, you know, to know or to have a feeling that something was inappropriate on their part.
That's understandable.
I mean, they do have presumably reasonably high standards for their university, for their behavior, their athletes. Although, obviously, I don't know how well that worked out.
So, you know, the question that kind of brings back to is why don't more victims choose to prosecute? So you've got the issue of false accusations. You've got the issue of unreported accusations. Why don't more women report?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had mentioned briefly that I had been assaulted, and I never reported it. I went home and cried.
Well, what was your...
I don't even know. I didn't want to talk about it. I fought the guy off. Yay. I feel really good about that. But at the time, I didn't feel really good about that. I felt terrible. I felt... and all these things are really dumb because, you know, I always sort of... I don't really... let's see. They sound ridiculous. You know, oh, I... guilt isn't the right word. I think that there's something in our culture, and I'm not even sure it's necessarily an entirely bad thing, but that that makes victimization an unhappy, you know, like something you don't want to talk about. I mean, I think there's something in our animal nature. Well, but I think it's part of our animal nature not to be weak. And, you know, so when you are in that kind of completely weak position, I think it's pretty natural to sort of just withdraw and not bring that out. You know, so in retrospect, like decades after the fact, I think that was probably a pretty bad thing because, you know, maybe I could have spared someone else trouble. I don't think I would have been very good at descriptions. I've always thought about that. Like, I've never been good about describing people after the fact. So I'm not sure how much good I could have done, but I feel like I should have made the effort. So I certainly understand. Well, I don't understand, but it resonates with me when people don't report or say they didn't report. Do we have an obligation to? I don't know.
I guess that's a really good question. Is there an obligation to?
I don't think there's any absolute obligation. I'm a libertarian. I don't think anyone should be forced to testify or anything like that. But whether we have an internal or moral obligation, I don't know.
I don't know. I guess my inclination on that would be that if we have any sort of moral obligation, that it's more to
other women.
It's more to speak up than it is to file charges. So, and I guess this loops back to what I was talking about before, where if you have been victimized, you need to make that clear so that the abuser doesn't get away with not thinking about their actions.
See, my case is a little different than the things we've been discussing. Excuse me. It was a complete stranger and not someone I could have easily traced down. So, as I say, I'm not sure that it would have been any good to anyone. But yeah, if it had been someone, a coworker or someone like that, I would have had a much higher obligation.
Yeah, and I guess in situations like you're talking about, that's assault, like you're saying,
right?
Before, where that's a kind of violence that you're never going to be able to completely filter out of society because, like,
right.
That's just, you know, violence from a stranger that you don't have any personal connection with who was making the choice to act that way. And that's never going to be something that we can completely eradicate because there's always going to be people.
It's also extremely rare. And it's interesting to me that so many people, you know, fear, you know, walking on a dark road, which is exactly where I was, or, you know, in a bad neighborhood or whatever.
You know, holding your keys between your hands.
Right. Because I've never been one of those people. And when it's always amusing to me in a kind of gotcha way when people say, oh, that's just because it's never happened to you.
You know who
actually it has. But I think the thing is, it is extremely rare. I mean, it would have been much more likely that I would have been assaulted while I was on a date. It's not because I never had any dates, or by someone I knew or someone I was seeing.
Well, you and I are both married. Statistically, the person most likely to harm or even kill us would be our husbands.
Correct. And never.
Yeah, so I know. I agree with you. That's always seemed like a weird mismatch to me, that like the situation that you're the most actually vulnerable in are those interpersonal, deep, intimate situations where you do have control over what you allow someone to do to you to a degree. I mean, I as a libertarian, I want to say, you know, completely, because you always have control of your body. You can always get yourself up and leave. Unless you are being physically, you know, forcibly held in an area. So I don't know I don't know where it's going with that.
I know, we're just gonna
I got distracted because the dogs need to be let out. Well, between the 5% conviction rate and the 5% false accusation rate, we're left with 90% he said, she said, where legally we really can't know one way or the other. So to me, this whole Me Too forces us to grapple with what do we do in that 90% of cases, and how do we make this overall experience of, you know, sexual assault or violence that, as we've discussed, is really an issue of how people who are in close quarters and in regular interactions are interacting with each other. How do we, you know, deal with that?
Yeah, we need to be able to draw boundaries without having lynch mobs go after every butt grabber. I'm not saying that that's appropriate, but...
Well, so you have really clear cases. Harvey Weinstein is your perfect... you know, example of like what the Me Too movement is supposed to be trying to speak out against. And Harvey Weinstein is a case where you can find a complete list of actresses sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein, along with their stories, in the show notes. But shockingly, there are over 50 women with credible stories. He is currently and officially being prosecuted by two separate women for various sexual crimes. And I'll just share a few notable stories here. Asia Argento alleges that Weinstein raped her when she was 21. She had been invited to what she thought was a party in his hotel room near Kane's, and she found herself alone with him instead. He changed into a bathrobe and asked her to give him a massage. She said she had reluctantly agreed, but that he pulled her skirt up and forcibly performed oral sex on her. She said she felt guilty about what she described as a horrible trauma and for not fighting him off. She later went on to have consensual sexual relations with him. Which she described to the magazine as a one-sided and onanistic, because she believed he would ruin her career if she didn't comply. After the rape, he won, she said. The British actress Lizette Anthony says she was raped by Weinstein in her London home in the late 80s. Anthony has given an interview describing the attack that left her feeling disgusted and embarrassed. She first met the producer in 1982 after being cast in the film Krull. It was a number of years later that Weinstein rang her doorbell. He pushed me inside and rammed me up against the coat rack in my tiny hall and started fumbling at my gown. He was trying to kiss me and shove inside me. It was disgusting. Unable to push him away, she continues, finally, I gave up. At least I was able to stop him from kissing me. Anthony has reported the rape allegations to the police, and they are investigating. Lucia Evans was an aspiring actor when Weinstein approached her at the Capriani Upstairs Club in New York in 2004. He arranged a meeting at the Miramax office where she found herself alone with him. He forced me to perform oral sex on him, she said. He's a big guy. He overpowered me. She blamed herself for not fighting harder and said that she was still haunted by it. Gwyneth Paltrow was 22 when she had been hired for the lead in the Jane Austen adaptation of Emma. She had been summoned to Weinstein's hotel suite, where he suggested that she give him a massage. She refused and felt petrified. She confided in her then-boyfriend Brad Pitt, who confronted Weinstein. And soon after, the producer warned her not to tell anyone else. I was expected to keep the secret, she told the newspaper. I thought he was going to fire me. Ashley Judd, a U.S. actor, has starred in a string of box office hits, was 20 when Weinstein invited her to the Peninsula Beverly Hills Hotel for what she thought was a breakfast meeting. Instead, he had her sent up to his room where he appeared in a bathrobe and asked if he could give her a massage or if she could watch him shower, she told the New York Times. Her thoughts were, how do I get out of this room as fast as possible without alienating Harvey Weinstein? Rose McGowan has reached a settlement with Harvey Weinstein following a hotel room encounter during the Sundance Film Festival. She had recently had a memorable role in the slasher movie Scream, which came out in 1996. I mean, there's countless, and just from reading a few out there, it seems like there's a little bit of a pattern there, too. But it's so prevalent that it was actually joked about. There was a case.
That's one of the things. It's in that case, it seems to be one of those everybody knew, but now it's unacceptable.
Have you ever heard of, there's an analogy I think works really well here called the broken stair analogy. The broken stair analogy is, imagine that you're at, you know, a house party or whatever that, you know, you're at a place where everybody hangs out and there's a staircase and there's one broken stair on the staircase that everybody knows about. And so everybody tries to make a point of telling somebody when they're new, oh, hey, there's a broken stair. So you just have to jump over it when you're going up the stairs. Otherwise you might hurt yourself. And that's a perfectly fine situation, everybody thinks, until you have someone who wasn't told. And because they don't know about the broken stair, they go up stairs, they don't jump, they fall and they hurt themselves. And then it's, oh, well, you didn't know about the broken stair? You really should have known about the broken stair. But the problem is nobody is bothering to fix the broken stair or address the fact that we have a problem in the first place.
Right, but with a broken stair, everyone agrees that.
Well, in that case, Harvey Weinstein is the broken stair.
Right.
It's not worth getting rid of him.
Yeah.
It's not worth fixing the broken stair. If we could just tell everybody you don't want to be alone with Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
The joke was during the 2013 Oscars, Seth MacFarlane made the joke after he listed the nominees for supporting actress. He said, congratulations, you five ladies no longer have to pretend to be attracted to Harvey Weinstein.
Eek.
But I mean, that was in 2013.
Yeah.
I don't know how much more of you get like an open secret than that.
Yeah.
You know, with so many instances, why do we keep letting, you know, that continue to happen? I mean, and these are not necessarily timid women.
It seems pretty shocking that in 13, when that joke was made, someone didn't say, wow, you know, I guess, no, even Twitter was around then. it's pretty shocking.
Yeah. Here's just one other that surprises me. Weinstein allegedly invited a 17-year-old Kate Beckinsale to his hotel room where he greeted her wearing only a robe. And a few years later, she said, he asked me if he had tried anything with me in that first meeting, and I realized that he couldn't remember if he had assaulted me or not. I think it just kind of encapsulates that this was set up as a normal thing.
Right.
In that realm, in that culture.
And I wonder if right now...
And that may be why we're hearing so much more from the film industry.
Maybe he's sitting around thinking, what did I do wrong? And that was acceptable. And now all of a sudden it's not acceptable. Like I was saying to you, someday I feel like someone's going to come to my house and arrest me for improper recycling, for not recycling enough. And I know that's not a fair analogy, but I wonder if, you know, how social norms change over time and if we're going through a period of rapid change where there's a lot of sort of back, totally not excusing Harvey Weinstein here. I know that's what it sounds like. I don't even know what he looks like, who he is really. It's just,
he's not. yeah. a particularly attractive man.
But I mean, that's not, you know, I have no sympathies one way or the other. I'm just saying, I do wonder, I wonder in a period of rapid change on a particular issue, whether some people are going to get caught. I mean, some people should get caught. And he sounds like a good candidate for someone who's been caught. And what he did was unacceptable at any time. It's the old thing, you know, in 1867, you know, were people saying, hey, my dad should not be, you know, arrested because he was a slave owner, because that was okay then. It wasn't ever okay.
Yeah. It's just what are we allowing at this point in our culture?
Right.
So, you know, I think to that, there is kind of that need for clarity. Like, at what point do we say, okay, now that we've renegotiated what's okay, we can all acknowledge that, well, what you did before was not okay. You can't be held responsible for that in the same way that you should be held responsible for things going forward. Right. And again, to me, the other side of that is then the expectation has to change for victims too, that the norm may have been that, you know, we understand that you have a lot of reasons not to speak up, and that you don't, you know, that there is a lot of shame feelings that go along with that, but that we have an expectation that people need to speak up in those situations more.
Right. So we talked about the not me thing. I am curious, though, and I maybe people can mention this on the page. I'm curious about anyone, you know, to know if there's one person here over the age of 20, one female who has not experienced some form of sexual impropriety, aggression, assault at some level. I really have a hard time thinking that that's possible. Again, not trying to make that sound as if it's acceptable or, you know, some sort of, you know, rite of passage or anything like that. I'm actually just curious. I have a hard time thinking that anyone gets through even their 20s without something happening. And I don't know how that applies to men. I don't know if it's the same or less, or I just don't know.
I think the message that men get around it is very different. The messaging that men get around it is you're supposed to like that. So like the messaging that women get around is I would agree, you know, it's hard to know somebody who hasn't dealt with that situation, but, you know, women are, it goes back to what we were talking about before, where women are supposed to be the victims and men are supposed to be the aggressors. Well, if men are always the aggressors, then how can they ever be the victims?
Right.
You must enjoy that. I mean, you've got like the case where, there's a teacher recently who was convicted of performing oral sex on a 13-year-old, I think it was. And she got like 6 months of probation for it. You know, to me, how much of that plays into the cultural narrative of like, well, I mean, she's an attractive young teacher. How bad must it have been for him? Well, it would have been just as traumatizing as any 13-year-old.
Right. Right.
So... I guess the one other case I just kind of want to mention real quick on that before we move to talking about how you move forward and how you can issue, you know, like you said, if everybody has had an experience of not necessarily sexual aggression or violence, but at least misconduct, and we agree that as a society we need to speak up more about when misconduct has happened, because that's the only way that you can get clarity around that is... If you feel like you've been violated by me, but I don't feel like I have violated you, and there hasn't been anything that we can both identify as a clear assault, then, you know, it's just as important for you to speak up. But then my version of that is I have to listen to you and understand your perspective so that I can adjust my actions. The one last case, though, I wanted to talk about, and back to why people don't report. That is the Larry Nassau case from the U.S. gymnasts.
Oh, not ringing a bell.
Oh, this was a big case. It's
I tend not to listen to the news because, well.
Larry Nassar was the doctor for the U.S. gymnastics team. Mm-hmm. His list of victims includes gold medalists, Olympic heroes, some of the most famous female athletes in the history of any sport. They ended up being a class action suit against him.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's pretty embarrassing.
156 is the number of women who ended up testifying. And in this case, a lot of these women, it wasn't an issue if they had never said anything. Gabby Douglas, who's a recent Olympic gymnast, was one of the victims. And a lot of these cases, these girls who were very young when they're gymnasts, say something. They speak up to coaches.
Catholic Church level.
That's, you know what, but that is the same thing too there. That's when people do speak up and it's not addressed within the structures that they're in. I'm just gonna read over some of the notes I have on this. Nassar pled guilty to 7 counts of first degree criminal sexual assault in Ingram County Circuit Court. He also pled guilty to 3 counts of first degree criminal sexual assault in Eaton County Circuit Court. He was sentenced to 60 years in federal prison on child pornography charges, to which he has admitted. John Gettard, the one-time U.S. Olympic women's gymnastic coach and owner of Twistars, was suspended from USA Gymnastics because he was one of the people who kind of allowed it to happen. And I think that's another question is how responsible are people who don't take action when these things are reported. Hours after the suspension announcement, Gettard says in letters to families whose children train at Twistars that he is preparing to retire. Nassar was sentenced to 40 to 175 years in prison on sexual assault charges. The hearing was expected to last 4 days with 88 victim impact statements. More women and girls came forward to speak, and in total, 156 women and girls made statements over 7 days.
Poor kiddos.
And the judges had denied an appeal on his 60-year federal sentence of child pornography. But in one of these cases, that just shows just kind of the egregiousness of this. Let me see if I can scroll it, find here. A student athlete at MSU reports concerns regarding Nassar to trainers or coaches, but the university failed to take any action. In 2000, a second student athlete at MSU reports concerns regarding Nassar to trainers or coaches, but the university failed to take any action. Nassar attends the Olympic Games in Sydney with gymnastics teams. Rachel Denholander, a gymnast, was sexually abused by Nassar during treatments for lower back pain in 2000. She was 15 at the time. In 2004, the alleged victim in Ingram County tells her parents about the sex abuse, but they do not report it to the police. Her parents. I mean,
well, I have some issues with gymnastics anyway, and at that level, with sports at that level at that age, that just adds to them. I mean, it's borderline, in my opinion, borderline abusive to have young people performing sports at that level, at that age. It's difficult to quash someone's hopes and dreams, but as you see, I wonder if that sort of acceptance of letting them, you know, be abused physically, honestly, indicates a willingness to let them be abused in other ways. I mean,
kind of an idea that, like, well, this is what you signed up for.
Yeah, it's tough. Oh, you got to push through. You know, no 13-year-old girl should be pushing through. I mean, no 13-year-old child. Sorry.
I guess that to me, that actually sounds a lot like what we hear a lot told to women who are in a typically male environment and dealing with a lot of harassment because of that is, well, I mean, you chose to be here. You should just learn how to deal with it. You should be a little bit stronger. You should, you know, not be so bothered by it. And that doesn't actually address the fact that there's still something going on that's not okay.
Well, I guess my point was more that if parents are willing to see their children possibly do lasting harm to their bodies through sports at that age, then it doesn't surprise me that some parents would also be willing to see lasting harm to their psyches.
Yeah.
At that age.
I mean, 156 is the number of women. Can you imagine how many abused women there were that also didn't come forward to speak up? I mean, how many less would it be if the parents or the coaches or the coworkers or the university hadn't ignored it and just kind of covered for him? I mean,
it astonishes me.
Why would someone cover for a sexual predator?
Right. That universities get into that. And that happens with athletics at all levels and misconduct at a lot of different levels.
And even in that case, Gabby Douglas made a comment to Sports Illustrated about it, where she said, "However, it is our responsibility as women to dress modestly and be classy. Dressing in a provocative or sexual way entices the wrong crowd." And she, in this case, was talking about being abused by her doctor.
Yikes.
I mean, why do even victims loop back to that? How was I involved in this? Or what did I not do enough? Or blaming each other even. You know, that the stereotype of, well, what were you wearing?
Right.
So let's then talk about the apology part.
Okay. I do want to talk about Cody Wilson. But let's talk about the apology first, because okay. I think Cody Wilson is kind of a segue, but I wanted to say that before okay. I forgot.
Yeah, well then.
Because it popped into my head as being very relevant.
It kind of is relevant to the yes. topic. Yeah. Yes. It's a new one. So what should an apology consist of? Because that's the obvious thing that's needed in these cases where you have someone who is, they're proven cases, and these men, it's usually men, just kind of go away and disappear.
Right. And addressing how can you move on.
Yeah. So in order to come back, Louis C.K. is a great example, who even recently, what he was accused of and actually very quickly admitted guilt to was masturbating in front of a lot of women without their consent. Which, I mean, that's really the only way to describe that situation.
Sure, go ahead. I guess there's some women who might. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're clearly trying to put yourself in that position to be masturbating in front
not
of someone.
Not seeing that.
Yeah. Yeah. He quickly gave his admission of guilt. His apology was, "I want to address the stories told to the New York Times by five women named Abby, Rebecca, Dana, Julia, who felt able to name themselves and one who did not. These stories are true. At the time, I said to myself that what I did was okay because I never showed a woman my dick without asking first, which is also true. But what I learned later in life, too late, is that when you have power over another person, asking them to look at your dick isn't a question, it's a predicament. The power I had over these women is that they admired me."
Sorry, predicament. Sorry.
Little puns.
Pun.
"The power I had over these women is that they admired me. I wielded that power irresponsibly. I've been remorseful of my actions, and I've tried to learn from them and run from them. Wait. And I'm aware of the extent of my impact of actions."
Is admiration a power over someone?
I don't...
That's hard.
I don't know. What the predicament is more of the... And maybe you can understand this more from just the female perspective on that, is that when you're in an uncomfortable situation with a man who is very comfortable pulling out his penis in front of you, your mind very quickly goes to, this could go really badly, really quickly. Okay. And sometimes you just go, if all you're going to be doing is masturbating in front of me, I guess that's better than the other options now that you've decided that this is an okay situation.
Yeah, no, but I mean, in the broader sense, is admiration a power we have over other people? What does that mean? I don't know. I'm trying to think. I can't even name any of the people I admire, because then to imagine them saying something like, "Can I masturbate in front of you?" just seems kind of, even in imagination, too uncomfortable.
Well, I imagine it was probably something more like, "Want to see my dick?"
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I'm just, I'm struggling with the idea that that's a power over someone, although it is, but it's a different sense of the word power.
I would agree with that. It's kind of a, it's not quite the same as, you know, a boss. It's very different from a boss. In fact,
very different. Or even a coworker. You summon Siri somehow. She's not sure she understands either.
So I feel like Louis C.K. really quickly got the first part that's really necessary in an apology, which is acknowledgement, which you can't get to when you have the he said, she said of a quick denial. And then you have to go through trying to decide who's right and wrong. And then if you have somebody who started with a denial and then has been proven guilty, we still have to get that first step of acknowledging the yes, I did this. But then step two has to be understanding why it was not okay. Because it's one thing to acknowledge that you've broken a social rule. It's another thing to acknowledge that it's a valid rule, that I understand why it's there, and that I understand why it was bad for me to have broken it. And the impact that it had on people. So, I mean, that's the, are you sorry you did it, or are you sorry you got caught?
Right.
To me, the perfect example for that, which I'll include a link to, is Dan Harmon. I played the apology for you before we had started, and it's fairly long, but he went to talking on his podcast. His situation was a much more clear issue of power, where he was a showrunner and was crushing on a writer that was on his team that he wrote checks for, that he, you know, decided whether or not she continued to have a job. And he went through trying to pursue her in a very, in a way that made her very uncomfortable, and that he acknowledged really well in his podcast in this. And I think the reason that's important is because that's the part that's necessary to start growing and learning from a mistake. Because things are forgivable.
Well, you followed these more closely. How was said apology received?
It was received very well, actually. She responded with a I believe she said that this is a masterclass in how to give an actual apology, and very publicly said, I forgive you. So thank you for doing that.
That was those two. How did other people receive it?
Other people seem to have received it positively, too. He hasn't been invited back to where he was previously working, but he is still, you know, back working within the industry.
Right.
He's still writing for shows. You know, he wasn't completely destroyed, because he's able to. I mean, and to me, it's part of that has to be at least because he's able to move on and going through that kind of redemptive process. And that's the third part of apologies, is going, now that I realize why I've done a bad thing, here's what I'm going to do to not make the same mistake. You know, and you see different people who have issued apologies, and some of them stop at step one or two. And there seems to be kind of a reflection in the mob as to how much they accept that, to how far they go. Like you've got the non-apology apologies of, I'm sorry that you experienced that way. I'm sorry that you misinterpreted my actions. I'm sorry that you got offended.
Right.
And then you've got I acknowledge that I've done a wrong thing. When can I come back? When am I done being punished, guys? Are we good? Have we made it even? But no, it's not the same as actually.
Well, an apology is not always going to work.
It won't.
There are some things that don't get by with an apology.
Do you think everything is all? Do you think most things are forgivable?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But there are things that are not forgivable by any particular person, any particular time. So anything can be unforgivable, but also anything can be forgivable. And it's hard to predict. I mean, I've seen people hold grudges over really ridiculous things, or sorry, things that I think are ridiculous or small. And then I've seen huge things forgiven. I tend to be not really so much forgiving as forgetting. I'm not good at holding grudges because I can't be bothered to like to remember stuff over and over. But some people, it's very difficult to not remember stuff over and over. I think every particular thing can be forgiven.
Okay. So let's talk about Cody Wilson real quick.
Yes, let's.
You want to
frame up?
Yeah, or? I was going to say, do you want to go through the situation? Because I've read like one article on that, mm-hmm. and went, oh, this is.
Yeah. Same thing. I'm not exactly up on it, but I do know. I don't know how much of this to preface with allegedly or so it seems or whatever, but apparently he formed a connection through an online site for hooking women up with wealthy men, which seems like a really kind of bizarre, but
it's more common than most people are familiar
with. I just didn't think there was any official or any sort of capitalistic channel for that.
I'm kind of impressed that Cody Wilson is on there as one of the
sugar
wealthy
daddy.
Men, though.
Yeah. So anyway, he did, presumably, and I'm not sure, maybe you could go to that site. Maybe they're shut down. I don't know. But presumably when you, okay, so he made a liaison from some site and, presumably had sex with the woman, and somehow, it's come out that she was at the time underage, whatever the age is there.
I pulled up an article on it. Mr. Wilson is accused of having sex with a 16-year-old girl at a hotel room in Austin, Texas on August 15th and paying her $500 in cash.
Ah, okay. So there's a couple questions there. You know, payment.
SugarDaddyMeat.com.
Right. So as a libertarian, of course, I'm fine with paying for sex. I'm fine with, you know, someone who is capable of giving consent regardless of the age. that's a cute site. On that site, do you have to declare that you're 18 or older?
It does. Looks like it requires you to be 18.
Yeah. So then we have the question of whether it was his responsibility to do any more due diligence than to say, I'm on a site where the women signing in had to say they were over 18. So why should I have to look at her bona fides when they've already been presented to the site? I mean, maybe that's why he went to that site, because he assumed that he was going to get someone screened.
To what point is he responsible for?
Right. And I don't even know what the charges are against him. You know, paying for sex, having sex with a minor. I don't know. I just have to say, I was impressed at how good your dog was at going over the mic line there. At any rate. I don't know, you know, I don't want to take there are questions about whether this was a setup. I just have to say in this, I don't know why people leave themselves open to this kind of thing. I mean, he seems like he's a really thoughtful guy, so I'm really a little bit confused about how easily entrapped people can be. Not saying that he was entrapped, but I'm a little startled by the whole situation. But aside from that, I'm having trouble seeing guilt in this case. You know, if someone has said that is their age.
At some point, you have to allow for, you know, like you were saying, mitigating circumstances where you can only go off of the claim that the person has made. I mean, are you supposed to cut their arm off and count the rings? Even if you got to the point of like asking for ID from any person before you become intimately involved with them, like fake IDs are a thing. I really agree with you on that. That's kind of hard to hold one party entirely accountable at the very least.
I agree. I totally agree, and I've heard either that interview or another where he's impressed me as someone who you know, if I were doing something like that, I'd be like, screw you, I'm publishing these plans. But no, he had a very deliberative approach. I'm following the law, I'm going to court, I'm making my case. And that doesn't seem to hold together with this kind of what one would consider reckless behavior. So
yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is very, very strange.
You know, I think that hits on one other aspect that we haven't kind of touched on yet, which also ties into the Brett Kavanaugh thing. Is there a difference between a single act and a pattern of behavior? And how important is that difference? Like, so this gets you to, like, one murder is enough to say that this person is a murderer. But can that same logic be extended to all situations? So, like, Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, even with murder.
Or even with murder. Like, okay, so let's take Brett Kavanaugh. Even if we assume that he is guilty of what he's accused of, which is assault but not rape, does that show evidence of a deep-seated, you know, flaw in his judgment and moral character? Or is that evidence of a single bad choice that was made? You know, is it really only a problem when you've got 156 women who are having a class action lawsuit against you? Or is it still a problem when it's just one person, one time?
Well, I think even more salient in this case is you have to ask who was a victim. Is there a victim?
Yeah.
Has this woman come forward and said, I was 16 and I lied to get on this site and now I regret it and I was a victim? I'm having a hard time seeing how that works. You know, even if she regrets having done it,
the police were notified of the alleged assault after the girl told a counselor and they confirmed the details using surveillance video and interviews.
Okay. So clearly she willfully signed up for this thing and then regretted it, which I can certainly understand.
Yeah.
Both instances. This is a really difficult one because do you have someone who's a victim? Yes. But what is she a victim of? Yes. Poor choices or the site?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, Mr. Wilson, who clearly must have thought she fell into the parameters of the site.
Yeah. There's no accusation of a lack of consent, just the assertion that because of her age, there is no consent.
Right.
Which is a whole other like conversation on how we determine age of adulthood and when you're, I mean, I've always thought that that's a little weird.
I would like to talk to her. I would like to know if she feels that he victimized her. How many other people did she see? Was it just one? Was she trying something out? A lot of times when we're teens, we do things like that. It's
you know, but I think that is even an example of is a poor choice being different than a pattern behavior. So if even she is the one who victimized herself in that situation, it's different than if she's continuing to do the same thing and move on as opposed to going, oh, you know what, maybe I made some poor choices and I don't want to continue doing that moving forward and I'm growing and I've learned from that. Shouldn't that same ability be assumed of anybody who, whether they're victimizing themselves through bad choices or have accidentally victimized somebody else?
There's so many things about this case that are not clear. Like what happened between, so she said something to a counselor at school or something, I don't know. And then that counselor said, clear assault, I should report this. The counselor reports it. And then what happens if this was someone who was in his mid-20s or mid-30s and no one had heard about, would something have happened? Would charges have been applied? Did someone's eyes light up when they saw the name? Because this is clearly someone who has not made a lot of friends at the, you know, at the law enforcement level. So I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I almost think that the most normal thing about it as a sexual assault case is that there's a lot of unanswered questions. And
this is just entirely too convenient.
That too. I will definitely agree with you on that. Which, again, seems to tie us back to the Brett Kavanaugh thing. I mean, that's the thing that keeps coming up about his case. This is entirely too convenient. Why did you wait until the last minute? Let's go ahead and just really kind of dive into that then. See, Christine Blasey Ford has a right to talk. He has a right to defend himself. Brett Kavanaugh does. Is his reputation tarnished forever, even if he is innocent? And if he is guilty, does that disqualify him? What I was saying before, a single action versus a pattern of behavior.
Do you think he'd be better off asserting his innocence or saying something clearly happened? It was clearly unhappy. It was clearly inappropriate.
I think that there's a third option, which is to acknowledge that this is something that's 35 years ago and that may have very well impacted your life, in this case, Christine Blasey Ford, much more than mine. This is something that you may have been dealing with that to her, it may have been a life-changing traumatic experience. To him, it may have been another night drinking with the boys. And it may just be something where he has never really thought that hard about it. And it's 35 years ago. He doesn't remember what he did at a party 35 years ago. I think there is room for him to have been able to have that option of, I do not ever remember doing anything like this. But if I did, then it is not okay. And I need to learn more about this. Like, what?
Doesn't that tread perilously close to, I'm sorry I got caught, or I'm sorry you were offended?
I don't know. To me, it seems like a better option because you are allowing for the reality that there are differences in perception. That to me, was not a traumatizing experience, that it really was not a big deal in my life. So why would I remember it 35 years later?
We took really good care of our slaves. They were like nannies to our children. They were just part of the family. I mean,
and you get away with it by not thinking about it.
I'm taking the wrong role here. I'm supposed to be that. I don't know. I wish these things were very clear. But they're not. Again, as with the Cody Wilson thing, the timing seems to be convenient for someone.
So, I mean, remember, there's a 90% chance that at the end of Ford's testimony and Kavanaugh's response, we still will know nothing more than we know now. It's a really crappy situation that kind of is uncomfortable because there's no good resolution. And
so what I don't understand, I mean, I understand where someone would think, I'm not comfortable with this guy in a position of power at the Supreme Court. However, he's had a position of power for some time and she was comfortable with that. I know I'm treading perilously close to victim blaming. I don't know. I don't know what I would do in a similar situation. I'm trying to think if. No, all the bad situations I've had were with people who were powerless then and probably less powerless, even more powerless now. So
I can understand the narrative that she has given as her reasoning where the reason she felt the need to speak up and say something is from like a civic duty perspective.
Yeah.
Because if you had somebody who did something to you terribly as a teenager and it affected your life, then, you know, that might be a person that you would think about more, and it would kind of be pretty terrifying to watch them rise through prominence as a judge. And I could see feeling like you need to say something. I guess I would wonder, he's a federal judge, right? I think, I believe yeah. He's a federal judge. So federal judges have to go through their own confirmation.
Right. And it is quite possible that she never really followed his career. I get that.
That's something that's actually been used to corroborate her. And friends who come up to talk about it to corroborate her story have said that, you know, she did mention a powerful man who is a federal judge now. who had assaulted her as a teenager, tended to not name him, though, but mentioned a federal judge who might be appointed to the Supreme Court one day. Her husband says that she maimed him.
So,
yeah, it's an uncomfortable situation.
Let's go back in time 35 years. What would have happened to this guy?
So, probably nothing.
Yeah, he would. Well, let's go back in time 35 years, but as if it were today. And they were both, you know, teens or whatever. And he had charges and maybe served some time. Would it still be possible that he would be a federal judge and appointed to the Supreme Court? I think so.
You really think so?
Yeah. Because if we're certainly 35 years from now, people who have faced these kinds of charges will be running the country. Because just like 35 years from now, everyone who's a congressman or on the Supreme Court will have smoked pot. I mean, and admitted it. Because, you know, we were going to have to move on somehow. And we can't disqualify everyone from ever serving, you know, based on, you know, and if everyone has some charge against them, I don't see how that's going to, how we are ever going to move on from that as a society. Well, that would be really great, actually, now that I think about it, if that kind of thing disqualifies everyone from being a politician, because all we have to do is have every politician or have every person smoke a joint, and then our government will dissolve. Over the next 20 years.
Is this the anarchist?
Yeah, the anarchist pie fantasy. In the sky dream. Yeah, yeah. Wow. So it's your uncivic duty, anarchist, to make sure that everyone smokes pot so that none of them can run for office in the future.
This is the peace pipe caucus, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard about this.
I don't even like pot, but I will admit to, you know, having smoked just so that I can't take office.
So one last angle on the Kavanaugh thing that one of my best friends pointed out to me, and I had to look more into and appreciated her take on that, was there was some breaking news this week from both the Washington Post and Politico about Kavanaugh's ruling that 17-year-olds are adults and responsible for their own decisions. The reporting was done so badly that you could finish reading the articles and still have no idea what the actual case said. So we went ahead to actually find the ruling. And in
this case, is the case in much reporting, by the way.
Yeah, terrible, terrible reporting.
That's a whole other story. Journalism.
So there was a case of where a 17-year-old immigrant girl was in custody due to crossing the border illegally, wanted to have an abortion.
17-year-old immigrant woman.
Woman. That's kind of what's at argument here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Being an immigrant, they could not locate her parents. An existing statute was that a parent or guardian over the age of 18 was needed to have an abortion. In this case, the judge, who was not Kavanaugh, ruled that she could indeed be allowed to have an abortion. Kavanaugh provided a dissenting opinion and attached it to the case file. He responds with the following. The majority seems to think that the United States has no good reason to want to transfer an unlawful immigrant minor to an immigration sponsor before the minor has an abortion. But consider the circumstances here. The minor is alone and without family or friends. She is in a U.S. government detention facility in a country that, to her, is foreign. She is 17 years old. She is pregnant and has to make a major life decision. Is it really absurd for the United States to think that the minor should be transferred to her immigrant sponsor, ordinarily a family member, relative, or friend, before she makes that decision? And keep in mind that the government is not forcing the minor to talk to the sponsor about the decision or obtain consent. It is merely seeking to place the minor in a better place when deciding whether to have an abortion. I suppose people can debate as a matter of policy whether this is always a good idea, but unconstitutional, that is far-fetched. After all, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the government has permissible interests in favoring fetal life, protecting the best interests of the minor, and not facilitating abortion so long as the government does not impose an undue burden on the abortion decision. It is important to stress, moreover, that this case involves a minor. We are not dealing with adults, although the majority's rhetoric speaks as if Jane Doe were an adult. The law does not always treat minors the same way as adults, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized in the abortion context. So Kavanaugh's statement is actually kind of the opposite of what has been reported. He's saying that she's too young to make a decision and that an immigrant sponsor acting as a parent and provided by the government was required to proceed with such a major life decision. He argues that she could proceed with the abortion so long as an adult approved. There's still a lot of things to discuss here.
Wait. I didn't hear so long as an adult approved. Because he said...
He says that she says that she doesn't even have to obtain consent, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even to talk to them, but that she should be in a situation... Well,
it depends on what state... It would depend on what state that they place her in.
Ah, necessarily. Right. Yeah, but that she should be in a situation where she has such adults available.
So the question that kind of brings up is...
Boy, that's got to give liberals fits. Let someone out of a detention center, make someone be with adults to make an abortion decision.
Mm-hmm. So should a 17-year-old girl need permission from an adult to have an abortion? And is a 17-year-old boy as responsible as an adult for a sexual assault? It's that issue of, like, when do full consequences kick in? When are you able to make good decisions, and how much should those decisions impact future? I mean, this is a thing I've actually heard coming a lot from conservatives on the Kavanaugh thing. Is, well, he was 17. You know, we all have made dumb choices when we're 17, and that shouldn't impact, you know, a grown man's career. But that's not necessarily applied equally. I mean, 17-year-olds make decisions that we are very comfortable. But I mean, this is one of the things that the USA is really good about. We are perfectly fine giving 17 and 16-year-olds life sentences. But at what point do they become responsible for their actions? Like with the Cody Wilson case. At what point is a 16-year-old responsible for having lied about her age more than the other person is responsible for not having known? I guess that really kind of leads into just a bigger, deeper conversation about why we draw the line where it is. Yeah. It's why we draw that line where it is. I've always thought it's really weird that the state says that in some places you can consent to sex at 14, but you can't drive until you're 16, and you can join the military at 17, but you can't vote until you're 18, and you can't drink until you're 21, and you can't... Well, that's private. You can't rent a car until you're 25.
Wouldn't it be fascinating? I'm surprised this has never come up that I know of, but if we had a congressman sponsor something, an increase in the age of military conscription, or I'm sorry, even military hiring. Like, no one could go in the military until they were 21.
In the
Seems pretty shocking that we think people are between the ages or before the age of 21 are too malleable and changeable to be able to be trusted with cigarettes or alcohol.
Well, the whole reason that we
go to the military, I know why they want people that young in the military, precisely because they're so malleable and plastic. That's why I would like to see, you know, a minimum military age of 21. I'd like to see a congressman sponsor that. I think that would be fascinating. I think it would be shot down. Ha ha, shot down. But that would be a great suggestion for a libertarian candidate for Congress. Just saying.
So, I mean, it's a very interesting kind of topic to delve into. So do you think that philosophically you kind of have to rule all the same way on all these cases when you're dealing with how old somebody is?
Yeah, no.
Do you think you can it is more philosophically honest to say that you can't draw a clear-cut line?
Yeah, maybe there's some really good psych test we can devise to let you know if a person is of a freely consentable age. Maybe there's what was it Rothbard used to say, that someone was fit to leave home when they declared they were ready to leave home. I don't know. Consent's not that simple, But it's also not the same for every person. And everyone acknowledges that, but it seems, you know, that people are more comfortable having some cutoff. I think this, the Cody Wilson case is a lot different because there's deception involved.
Yeah. So, you know, I just thinking a little bit more about your comment about the military. Always, it's funny how many people don't realize that the whole reason that we allow 18-year-olds to vote is because we want to be able to draft them. And so, like, when we first were instituting the draft, at the time, the voting age was 21.
Right.
But 18 to 20-year-olds had a real big problem with the idea that you're going to send me off to war forcibly.
Whole Vietnam thing.
But yeah. I'm not allowed to vote.
Yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't be forcibly sending them off to war either.
Maybe. Yeah.
Just an
maybe.
Idea. Yeah. Well, we have spent way more time on this than either of us thought we would. Do you want to go ahead and offer final thoughts on the subject?
I don't have anything final. That's the sad thing about it. I just feel like it's not an easy question. Anyone who thinks it is hasn't thought about it enough.
I think that in order for this to at some point be a movement that has ended, it's going to require us culturally being able to kind of like draw a line in the sand. Like with the civil rights movement, with like any big movement that we've had, even abolishing slavery before that, there is a line that we've drawn in the sand where we acknowledge that a lot of us who are going to have to build a society together and learn how to work together moving forward. A lot of us did horrible, objectionable things in the past, and we're not justifying that. And that was not okay. But now that we've clarified that and that we all understand the new expectations going forward, we understand that that was a different time under different expectations, and that you cannot, that you shouldn't expect to hold someone accountable in the same way.
That makes a lot of sense. As most things you say.
Well, I appreciate that. But, I mean, Twitter is the place where we have public conversations now, which is just terrifying.
That's horrifying, yes.
But, you know, it is...
I feel like something good happened on Twitter lately, but I can't remember what. It's usually horrifying. What was that? Oh, well, yeah. No, but I mean, someone said something reasonable on Twitter. It was shocking enough that I remember, but I obviously can't remember it now.
Well, I do think, you know, there are good conversations that happen in the realm of social media. I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Instagram.
But being the internet is a place where there's, at least currently in America, there's less censure than like we can give to each other in real life. It does become a dumpster fire in some areas, because that's what happens when you allow anything to happen. But that doesn't mean that good, productive conversations aren't happening away from the dumpster fire, or like slightly off to the side where we're watching the dumpster fire and discussing it.
One of the things I liked about Twitter was the short form message. I thought that was kind of a cool way for people to have to make a point, make a salient point, make it quickly, and move on. But it turns out to be a really powerful way for people to say things that are harsh, easily misinterpreted, angry, without any kind of explanation. So, I don't know. Maybe I should give Twitter another try.
I've never been able to sit down and deal with Twitter for long enough. So, I think it's about time that we go ahead and wrap up. Is there anywhere that, if anybody is dying to ask you more questions, Susan, they could reach out to you? Or, I mean, you're also free to just completely withhold any information as well.
People can reach out to me anywhere. My phone number is 919-906-2106. Free to text me. You're free to call also, but I never answer the phone, so leave a voicemail. And you can always email me at hogarth@gmail.com. So that's my last name, H-O-G-A-R-T-H. I'm always happy to hear from people. If you stalk me on Facebook, I respond to Messenger a lot faster than email.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on with us today. And
thanks for having me.
Hopefully all of our listeners have enjoyed this episode of We Are Libertarians, and we encourage you to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast feed in Apple or iTunes or Stitcher or Google Music, wherever you happen to find. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel. I'm going to have a shameless moment of self-promotion to please go ahead and check out the Fundamental Freedom series on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook. It's once a week, Sundays at 8. You get to listen to me talk for 2 to 3 minutes about a topic related to libertarianism. And
I've really enjoyed those.
Thank you. I've been terribly stressed for the first few, but it's much more comfortable now.
They're super.
So, and I actually...
I like 2 to 3 minutes. That's about my attention span.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually had feedback from one of actually our state party members who said he really thinks that it would be better if they were done in longer segments, or at least released all at once so that you could binge watch them.
I wonder who that was.
And yeah, I was like, I appreciate that. And you will be able to binge watch at some point. But, you know, we want to make sure to have enough for everybody's attention spans. I think that's about it.
So long.